This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is Startup Confessions, episode 6.
We made it to 6.
Six. Next week will be the last one. I promise it's the last one. I am Angeline Tay. This show essentially is to get startup founders to share their failures and mistakes. Again, we've covered quite a bit extensively. Pre-startup fundraising, I think that's a popular topic. Finding the right founders and also finding investors. And today we have Jasmine Loa, founder of Recommend, and Sean Lee, founder of Milk a Deal. Two startups that's in a very interesting situations. And all thanks to Aaron Sarma, founder of Touristly, who's been helping out, you know, to run out all the startups we've been featuring in our previous episodes. Today, Recommend Milk a Deal. Aaron, you've coined a title for this.
This is the David versus Goliath episode.
Yes. And why is that?
Because what we see, and I guess you guys will give an introduction, is you're both in very competitive markets. And how do you deal with a market that's very busy with lots and lots of competition, and how you deal, whether or not it was through a pivot or through it's raising more funds, or how you deal with that, or in providing a better service than your competitors. So I thought this would be a fun episode.
Yeah.
And be quite fun. So I guess I'll introduce myself at this time. I'm the founder and CEO of Touristly. We're a travel platform that helps you find things to do for whenever you want to travel. So after you've booked your hotels, you've booked your flights, and you want to find out, what do I do once I get to the destination, the fun and exciting stuff, you come to Touristly, create an itinerary, and you can book it right away.
So I'm Jasmine. I am one of the co-founders of Recommend.com. So Recommend is a service that helps match customers to service professionals like renovation contractors, photographers, you know, cake bakers. And these service professionals are those that are recommended by the community. So all you need to do is come to us, let us know, you know, what event you're planning or what project you're trying to do. And in a matter of hours, we will match you up to 4 service professionals who are recommended by the community.
My name is Sean. And I'm from milkadeal.com. We are an online cashback portal, so we pay people to shop online. For example, if you're looking to buy an iPhone from Lazada, as an example, you'd start your shopping trip from our site, and then you'd be redirected to Lazada's website where you complete your purchase as you normally would, and your cashback will then appear on your Milk a Deal account the next working day. The cashback that we actually give actually comes from the advertisers. We get a fee, which we then split with our users as cashback, and we keep a small portion as our own revenue. The same applies for also travel sites like Touristly is one of them. We've got Agoda, Expedia, and many other sites.
So Sean, I mean, before today, we've never actually met, but
Correct. We've
actually had lots of encounters, because before this, I was running a day deals platform,
Yep. Which
is very much a competitor of Milk a Deal before you changed the cashback model.
Correct.
I thought I'd ask you basically, what was it like in the early days? Because I remember when we started Street Deal in Malaysia, we had something like 50 competitors in the market, and it's since winnowed down to less than 5.
Correct.
So
yeah.
What was your experience during that time, and how deal with that? Facing
it was,
giants
no pun
in the market.
Intended.
Yeah. It was exciting times. I remember every other week, or at least once a week, a friend of mine would send me a link with another site that has just come up. And then they could be from anywhere. It could be from KL, could be from Johor, could be from Singapore. Back then, there was a lot of noise because it was so hot at that time. It was this wave of people suddenly coming online to buy stuff for the very first time, and they're buying it through these daily deal sites through us. So we were too busy to actually really think about all the other things. Our focus was get good quality merchants, make sure that our customer service is tip top. But you're right, it was chaotic.
I remember there were times when my sales guys would go to a restaurant and they'll say, hey, the Milk a Deal guys are in the table next door waiting for their appointment. So it was that intense, I remember.
It might have been me.
Yeah, it might have been you. Yeah, and we may have actually met at one of those places as well. So.
Yeah. That was, I think, back in 2011 when we started as a daily deal site. Right up to May 2015, that was when we changed to a cashback portal. And I think the interesting thing is that a lot of people didn't know before was that I think two years into this daily deals business, we actually built a warehouse. We set up a warehouse to actually start holding our own stock.
Oh, so the rumors are true.
The rumors are true.
Okay.
Yeah. That's all we had to do to survive. Yeah. So we did a lot of things that a lot of our competitors didn't know back then.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that really helped us a lot to actually rough it out during that period, you know, from that 50 competitors to now, I think there's only like 5 players.
Yeah. Or less than that, yeah.
Yeah.
And what made you make that decision? Because I've seen a lot of the companies who are no longer daily deal sites, and they've all pivoted to something else.
Correct.
Most of them went and became e-commerce sites. Yeah. The company I was with before became a subscription model, and it builds on that. But you went to cashback. What made you choose cashback as the way?
Actually, I would say we went to e-commerce first, but we just went in really early. Because we were already selling products as the site itself. Yeah. It's just that from a user experience, it looks like it's being fulfilled by a third party, but it's actually fulfilled by us.
Right.
And actually, the reason why we do it was not so much of competition. It was because we were very annoyed by merchants who just couldn't fulfill something that they promised.
Right.
I get very annoyed when that happens. I lose my mind. Because at the end of the day, it's your company's reputation that is at stake, not the third-party merchant. So it's very important to get that right, we felt. So that was the main reason that pushed us to actually do our own fulfillment, to take control, to take back control of the customer experience. We went down to cashback in 2015 because we realized that we weren't offering much value to our users. Right. Again, the user part came in first because in terms of product selection, we couldn't beat what our bigger competitors like Lazada, Groupon, and Sogo, these big boys have raised a lot of money. We can't beat that, right? Mm. We didn't do crazy rounds of fundraising. Right. So we realized, you know, if we can't beat them, we have to think of a way to complement them.
Right.
And at the same time, be able to provide genuine value to our users.
Mm.
Because before the pivot to cashback, our repeat purchase rate of our customers was at 70%.
That's right. Yeah.
7 out of 10 of our customers were buying more than once. So we knew we had a loyal customers. And it was because of them that helped us last so long as well.
Maybe Jasmine, you could share a bit about your story as well. So I understand Recommend is in a very competitive space. Everybody's trying to be the Uber for
services
and to get easy service through various platforms. So how do you deal with a situation where there's so many competitors? So I guess what you're going through now is what we went through
2, 3
years ago. And how do you deal with it now that you see all these different guys coming up almost overnight with a new idea, and how do you remain competitive?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. When we started off about, I think, a year and a half ago, we were pretty much the first guys in town that applied, you know, a certain model. So we had a subscription model where, you know, if you came to search for service professionals on our platform, you'll be able to see, you know, who are the top service professionals that are recommended by the community, and you'll be able to sort of like contact them directly. And after we run it for a few months, we realized that it was one of those models that required a lot of capital to actually push, because unless you have a huge volume of traffic, it will be very difficult, you know, to justify a subscription model. You know, after the team, we actually were part of the Magic E at Stanford program. You know, we went over there, you know, we looked at several different models that worked in the States, what worked and what didn't. And based on the advice that we were given, we actually wouldn't say pivoted, but we actually changed a little bit our business model to what it is today, where a customer, you know, instead of goes and searches, the customer tells us what they want, and then the service professional then, you know, does a proposal. At the time, I think it was very interesting because, you know, then different players came onto the market and we were like, whoa, we didn't know that this model was going to be, you know, you know, interesting in a sense. And then this model, which is, you know, essentially the Thumbtack model in the US, what they did was they raised $100 million from Google Capital. And then, you know, the year after they raised $120 million. So it was, you know, it showed a lot of potential as the model that would be able to scale. So that's how we actually changed our business model to what it is today. And you never know, you know, right now it's the way it is, but you never know, you know, we might actually change or we might actually adapt our business model furthermore to Malaysia and Southeast Asia in particular.
So do you feel that in Asia there's a specific style that you can adopt or a slant to the business that gives you a bit of an edge compared to other people in the market?
I think in Southeast Asia and in services in particular, there's probably not one model that works across. And the reason is because when you look at services, you know, it could be anything from a high value service like a renovation, which, you know, the big ticket item. And it could be something really small, like, for example, you know, please come and fix the plumbing in my kitchen, for example. So because of the variety of services that we're dealing with, there are perhaps a few models that people have actually used and to actually deal with these different types of services. So I don't think there's one particular model that works, but there are many, many models that could cater to the wide range of services.
Do you have anything that you've made and you wish that, you know, you can rewind and not do it?
Wow, you know, we were talking to Sean about this earlier on, and we were like, oh, do you have a 4-hour slot?
I don't think there's enough time.
Yeah. In a series that lasts a year, to snip it up.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about running a startup, right, is that because you are running so fast, you don't have time to do like 2 months of analysis before making a decision and, you know, heading towards that direction. So you're pretty much saying like, okay, you know, based on the data that I have, this feels like the right thing. And so you take 2 steps in that direction, and then you realize like, hey, maybe not exactly this, but maybe something else different. So you kind of like, you know, adjust your course mm-hmm. based on the information that you're getting every time you take a few steps. So I think we have made, you know, our fair share of mistakes. One of the larger ones, in my opinion, is that we didn't raise money quickly enough. We didn't raise funding enough. Mm. Because, well, I'm an ex-consultant, right? What was very important to, you know, us back then was, you know, before you actually implement something, you need to make sure that your analysis is right. You need to, you know, have a very high degree of confidence that something is the right answer before you actually head down there, because, you know, millions and potentially even billions are on the line. So we needed to get to a stage where we were very confident that this would be the winning model before we then say to our investors, hey, look, you know, invest in this because this is a sure win one. Right. Whereas, you know, in startup, it's more like when people raise seed funding, the entire purpose of it would be to give the team a little bit more time, you know, to pivot and find the right model. So I think, you know, if we were to do it again, we would potentially have raised money earlier rather than having like a, you know, such a high degree of certainty before we then, you know, open it up to investors.
Now, this raised the question where, as a startup founder, you're faced with a dilution dilemma because raising capital can be a double-edged sword. Jasmine Lua from Recommend will share more of a story after the break. This is Startup Confessions on Up the Ante, Episode 6, with Sean Lee, founder of Milkadeal, Jasmine Lua from Recommend, and Aaron Sarma from Touristly, BFM 89.9.
Build fortunes modestly. BFM 89.9.
Good morning, you're listening to Startup Confessions, Episode 6. On the panel today, we have Sean Lee, founder of Milkadeal, Jasmine Loa from Recommend, and Aaron Sarma from Touristly.
I mean, we were sharing with before the show about how, as a startup founder, when you're raising funds, you're faced with this dilemma. You can either raise a lot of money and dilute yourself, or raise just enough and dilute yourself a little bit and hope to see the light of day for the next round and dilute yourself some more. So, did you have that moment when you raised your round and then you saw maybe a competitor come back and raise like 5 times the amount? And how did you deal with that?
Yeah, you know, I think the interesting thing about this, right, is that, you know, when do you actually raise?
Yeah.
Do you raise at the beginning where the risks are high in a sense, right? And you say, okay, you know, this seems like a good idea. I'm going to spread it amongst 7 people. So if we fail, we all fail together, you know? Or do you say like, hey, hold on, you know, reputation and all that is slightly more important. So I'm going to wait until I'm personally more convicted before we actually, you know, spread the risk around. I think it depends on your, you know, your own resources, your personal sort of like risk tolerance in a sense. And how do you actually view this thing? You know, how do you view failure, for example?
Right.
Do you see failure as like, okay, I tried my best. Mm. So, you know, you guys knew what you were coming in for and, you know, or would you actually say like, I'm going to wait until at the point where I can give you the best sort of like return on your investments before you actually raise around. So it depends also on the personality, I think, of the startup, the character of the startup founders.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. And I also think there's no right or wrong with as to when you raise and who you raise from and all that kind of thing. A lot of it, at the end of the day, is making things right. I mean, that's one. And secondly, also, I think the thing that should probably take precedence over fundraising is whether you've got something, a good product.
Yeah.
You know, because if we go out and raise for the sake of raising funds, you just end up with, you lose other people's money, that's one. Yeah. And also, you don't have a good product that can sell. So I think ultimately what's most important is that you actually have a product that can get some traction.
I think it's also very interesting how the startup world views funding.
True.
Because if you look at a typical company on a stock exchange, for example, right, raising debt and raising equity is something that they think very carefully about because it really impacts, you know, the kind of decisions they need to make about their business. For example, when a company raises equity instead of raising debt, you do know that the decisions that they make would be on a higher sort of like risk spectrum that the debt wouldn't support, for example. But in the startup world, raising funds seem to be sometimes even more important. than having, you know, a proper story, having good customer service, for example, having people, you know, use your product.
And why is that?
They read TechCrunch.
Yeah, they read TechCrunch, right? And so, you know, they run 3 months and they realize like, gosh, you know, this thing is quite expensive. We need to raise some money, right? As opposed to the typical, I don't know, how old are you, Aaron?
Old enough.
Oh, you've just 36. Put him on the spot.
I'm 36.
As a typical 36-year-old founder who has
lots of grey hair, who has perhaps
you know, done a few years in the corporate and has, you know, has some savings. So he's able to run a little bit further and test a few more hypotheses before he says, you know, I think it's ready to scale and raise funds at that point. So I guess that's one of it. Well, the second one is when you are dealing with technology startup, because of the fact that the barriers of entries are very low. Right. Anybody can come up with a website, typically. So the challenge is to do it quickly enough such that you scare the next person from coming in. And so in order to do that really, really quickly, you cannot rely on organic growth, which means you cannot rely on people telling people that this service is great. You need to put like massive amount of ads on Facebook and really flood people's like, you know, Google. And that is why fundraising needs to happen so early in the life cycle of a startup.
I think that is especially relevant if it's a consumer-facing product.
Yeah.
So if you're a marketplace, if your customers are going to be the mass consumer market, that becomes very, very important. Especially with e-commerce, people used to have this impression, and I think a lot of people still do. They think that, oh, you know, I just set up a website and I'll make money and I'll be rich. No, it doesn't work that way. Especially if it's a consumer product. If you, whatever you're selling, you're going to make sure that the margins are right. You're going to make sure that the size of the product is not too big, because logistics is a big part of e-commerce. So the most ideal situation, if anybody is selling stuff online, is small, lightweight, high-value items and high margins.
Sean, I wanted to ask you, you've been, how long has Milk a Deal been around for?
2011, so that's five years. Yeah.
Wow, that's an eternity in startup years.
I know,
it's
It's
like dog years, and I had seven.
You're right, I've aged so much as well from running a startup.
You probably had more hair then.
You're right. Oh my God, you're like the 10th person who told me that.
How has your team evolved during these transitions that you've had? Has the team been very, have they been tight? Or has there been ups and downs? How did he?
There's always been ups and downs. There's been we've gone through an upsize, we've gone through a downsize, we've gone through a merger, we've gone through an acquisition. We've done a lot in that 5 years, and obviously with the team, you know, sometimes, like for example, when the most recent one being when we actually had to. We gave up our warehouse basically. Yeah. So we had warehouse staff, and then we had to basically tell them that, you know, we're not doing fulfillment anymore.
Right.
Those times are always, it's never easy. The thing is that we don't hide things from them. We tell them, we give them like months in advance. We help them find jobs if we have to. We refer them to our friends, especially, you know, like they're good people, right? And just because of the change in the business need, you know, so we try to support them as far as we can. But it's never been easy, you know, especially when you have to let people go. Yeah, that's the worst, is usually the worst day of the year.
And what gives you strength in those moments? Because you're kind of facing the edge of a cliff, you know, how do you do that?
You know, when you say that, right, it brings back so much memories. Yeah, we've had to do it twice in that 5 years. I think having partners with you is very important because the burden is shared. I think if I had to do it myself, it would have been tough.
Do you have anything else that happened in your startup?
We also had two other sites in the past.
Oh, that's right. I remember this.
We had white.my.
Yeah.
Why white was because it was meant to sell white goods.
Oh, is that why? Okay.
That was the reason why it was white. Yeah. So white goods like fridge and your fridge, your washing machine, that sort of stuff. But we ended up selling more designy stuff at the end because that was... that
it became kind of like a fab kind of site after a while, right?
Yeah, correct. But we stopped it. Yeah. So we invested money in it and then we stopped it because we... Logistics So one thing about e-commerce is that your products, not only must your margins be sufficient, the size, it cannot be too big, because when it's big, it adds up to your logistics costs and you won't make money to sustain. We also had a cosmetic store called Hi Shop.
That's right.
And there's a reason, the logic behind why we had these other sites was because we had a bunch of customers, e-commerce customers who buy online, and these guys were mainly women. You know, our customer base, 70% are women. So we kind of know, okay, that's a demographic. We can cross-market between these sites. I mean, each of these sites still have to earn their own customer bases, but we will cross-promote in a fair way. So White, we actually ended up, I think we stopped it maybe 2 or 3 years ago. That was a long time ago. That we had stock for everything. You know, that was our own store. We stopped it because logistics, it just didn't add up. It was running on like one staff, I think, one or two staff at most for fulfillment and for getting stock and all that kind of stuff. But the logistics cost killed us. Hi Shop, we actually sold off to one of our brand partners last year. So they took over the business and they're running it as it was before with the existing brand partners and products.
I think Sean has brought up a good point. I think for everything that happens in the marketplace, right, there's always some parties that gain and some parties that lose. And the parties that gain are usually those who manage to, you know, find some kind of solution that takes advantage of that movement in the market. And I think that's very interesting. Coming back to competition earlier, you know, people always say, oh, competition, you know, that's bad. You know, how do you deal with it? You have so much competition. But I think the more positive way to view competition is that competition is actually pretty good. You see, when we started off with about 1.5 years ago, nobody in Malaysia would even think of going on a website and telling the website what they want and having people propose to them. Today, it's pretty much, you know, people do that. What? Might not be us, might be our competitors, but they are also effectively our extended marketing arm and our extended business development arm, because, you know, they go and, for example, educate the market. And then the market can then choose, you know, which of these players are, you know, actually beneficial.
So you're saying like a rising tide floats all boats.
Pretty much. Yeah. And also, you know, don't forget that when we are dealing with tech startups, it's often, you know, a small pie at the beginning. Instead of fighting for pieces of the pie, why not try and see how we can grow the pie together?
Right.
Because in the end, you know, different customers want different things. But if we all work together to sort of like expand the pie, then we could all find a way to, you know, find our own niche and also thrive and survive and thrive.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I always think that if you are in a business with no competition for too long, you should either, you know, run really quickly because you're really lucky, or run away because it's something that you will never
it's
work.
It's a business nobody wants to do. Yeah.
Yes.
But that's a fine line that could be very hard to know, right?
Like, oh, absolutely.
Do I run or do I stay?
Run quickly or do I run away, right?
Okay. Well, any final thoughts and a shameless plug?
Well, I'm giving away 10 ringgit bonus cash back.
Nice.
All you have to do is go to milkadeal.com /BFM. And it's a sign-up bonus. So hopefully you'd spend a little bit more, buy a bit more stuff and boost the economy.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, you know, since Sean is giving away 10 ringgit, I think we might as well. So Recommend actually has a referral program where if you see, you know, anyone on Facebook asking, hey, do you know a good plumber or do you know a good a contractor or do you know a good cake baker, you know, you can get your own referral code from us, and if the person actually signs up with your referral code, you actually get 10 ringgit and the other person also gets 10 ringgit towards any of the services that we have on our platform. So, you know, go and check your referral code and start sharing.
Thanks guys, it's been fun talking about how you've handled like a competitive environment, how you've focused on delivering good service to your customers, and I think that's really something very admirable and really great.
Okay. Are you giving away 10 ringgit as well?
So, just to so since we're doing the plug thing, I can do the plug. So if you're planning a holiday in this year, there are lots of long weekends. So I hope you check out Touristly, touristly.com. You've booked your flight, you've booked your hotel, come to Touristly, plan the activity. And so today, there are two ways for you to get a benefit from using Touristly. You can either go to cashback.milkadeal.com and get 10% off and make Sean and I happy together.
Thank you, Aaron.
It's a win-win situation.
It's a win-win because we're from that industry. It's win-win all the way, right? Or you can use the BFM promo code for 28.8% off on your trip. Use BFM28 and you can get that for your next trip.
Thank you so much for your time. In the studios, we have Jasmine Lua, founder of Recommend, Sean Lee, founder of Milkadil, and also Aaron Sarma, founder of Touristly. This has been the episode 6. Next week will be the last one.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we'll end it with a big bang. We don't know who's coming on yet.
Yes, you don't.
Fingers crossed, K-Fit and... Well, we're not sure. Well, we're just hoping we can get them. So if you know anyone, do, you know, recommend this, ask them to come on for the show.
Can you use your platform,
Jasmine? Looking for a panel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we wouldn't know, right? I mean, what if we manage to get them on, and what sort of questions you would like to ask them? You can always tweet us at BFM Radio, hashtag Startup Confessions. Write into us, enterprise@bfm.my. You've been listening to Startup Confessions, episode 6. I'm Angeline Tse, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.